What if your backyard could feed you for decades with way less work than planting an annual tomato patch and vegetable garden? That comes with fruit trees that just keep giving you more and more bounty year after year as the plants establish. So I met arborist Alan. He's the founder of Conservation Tree Care when I was in Seattle at Northwest Flower and Garden Show earlier this year. He gave a great talk on fruit trees for your backyard, but more importantly, teaching you how to grow them, why pruning isn't as scary as you think it might be, and the surprising timeline behind your first harvest when it comes to planting fruit trees in your backyard. I know that I am very excited to have fruit trees in my backyard now that I am a homeowner, and I think many people would love to have plums and apples and an abundance of other delicious foods. For me in Florida, it's mangoes. So in today's episode, you're going to learn how to grow fruit trees in your backyard with confidence, patience, and you're going to have a whole new appreciation for trees in general.
Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants.
Plant care is self-care on Growing Joy.
Welcome, Alan. So happy to have you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to be here.
I think so many gardeners' dreams are to have that backyard orchard or that backyard, for me, citrus farm. So I'm excited to chat with you because it really is a different beast. I was so interested in doing research on you that you have a real background in forestry. And I don't think I've ever interviewed someone specifically geared towards forestry. So what is forestry and why have you been drawn to it your whole life?
I think the funny thing is really forestry and gardening have a lot in common. It's just the management of a natural landscape, often for human benefit, but sometimes to improve wildlife habitat or to have other environmental benefits. And so I was probably a sophomore at the University of Vermont, just, you know, arts and sciences undeclared, didn't know what the heck I wanted to do with my life. And I took a forestry course by this professor, Michael Schneider, who is also a county forester in Vermont. So he was both an educator, but then he was also a practitioner. And it just really captured me as something that I could really wrap my hands around. And after many years of learning so that you could learn so that someday you could learn a little more, I just think I found it really refreshing to encounter something where I could really imagine how what I was learning could be practically applied. Real tangible things that you can do that have an impact on a forest and an ecosystem. And I found that really inspiring. And that's why I ended up pursuing forestry. And then the funny thing is arboriculture and forestry are actually very similar. It's just the size of the population that you're dealing with, which is the big difference. So in arboriculture, it tends to be that you're dealing with either individual trees or small groups of trees, or maybe like a small residential property or on the big side, like a campus. And so it's really just the number of trees that are involved. And so maybe in arboriculture, we're giving a lot more care to individual trees. And in forestry, they have to obviously see the forest for the trees to some extent.
It sounds like forestry is also like kind of the study of the interaction of all the trees, where arboriculture is more like it could be one tree.
Yeah, it certainly could. Sometimes you have an individual tree standing all on its own. But even in that setting, there's a lot of various interactions with, you know, abiotic factors in the site, you know, the non-living things like the water and the soil nutrients. But then also there's a lot of biotic interactions as well. You know, some of them good, like mycorrhizal fungi, some of them bad, like maybe you have some sort of parasitic fungi that's involved or some other insect that damages the tree. So it's this thing where, you know, there's always other things going on and there's always one more level of complexity, no matter how much you think you're wrapping your mind around it, then it's nature. It's just so much more complex than we'll ever really be able to understand.
Did you ever read the book, The Overstory?
You know, I've been recommended that book by so many people.
I bet.
And I've started it a couple of times and I just, it's funny. I think I'm so practically minded. I can see why people love it and the big flowery descriptions of trees.
Mm-hmm.
But I just haven't been able to get into it. My it's funny because it's like I'm so drawn to trees and they're really the passion of my life. And I've spent a lot of time both professionally and recreationally in forest settings. And I just find trees to be these incredible things. But I guess for me, there's just no substitute for actually being there and putting your hands on them.
And if it's your job, you might not want to be just like recreationally reading about fiction about them.
I would really recommend if anyone's interested in just learning more about how incredible trees are, the work of Robert Van Pelt. He's a scientist and an artist based out of Seattle who has studied old growth trees along the West Coast extensively. And his artwork, where he goes and sort of takes pictures and then draws these old growth trees, everything from Western red cedars to Douglas firs to ponderosa pines. The guy's like an explorer who has just searched for big charismatic trees. And his artwork is both scientific, but then also some of the most beautiful art I've ever seen. It's like pen and ink drawings of these really charismatic trees. And that's really my jam, especially when science and art merge. I think that's my happy place.
That's beautiful. I only bring up the overstory. OG listeners who are listening in 2020 when I read the book, I mean, hooked. I was so hooked on this book. This book was my favorite book, or is my favorite book. But I thought of you because old growth redwoods are like one of the main characters of the book. As the book progresses, you realize that like the trees end up being the main characters. But there's one of the sub stories of the book, because there's like five different sub stories that kind of all interweave with each other, are these people who climb the trees on ropes. And when I was on your website and I realized that like that's kind of one of your specialties is that you know how to like climb to the top of these huge trees with ropes, and you know, you have photos like dangling off of these like enormous trees, pruning them and stuff. I was like, oh my God, he's doing what they talked about in the overstory, like how they used to just like climb the trees like that, which I just think is so cool. And you're also a rock climber, right?
Yeah. And I was actually a rock climber long before I was a tree climber. So probably would have been late in high school. I had a friend introduce me. Actually, it's funny. Introduced me to rock climbing and tree climbing. He was an arborist, but we mostly went rock climbing because that's just a much more accessible thing for most people. Mm-hmm. The equipment's a bit simpler and the learning path is a bit more well-traveled.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas becoming an arborist, there are a few people that tree climb recreationally, but most of the time it's the sort of thing you learn on the job. So you've taken an entry-level job with a tree company. We always need people that help working on the ground. And then that's where you start your career and you're typically taught how to climb from there. But coming in with a background in rock climbing or mountain climbing is really advantageous. And that I think that's the other thing that I just found really appealing about the profession was it's this really unique blending of physical work. And
very actually, physical.
It's often referred to as being an industrial athlete, which is sort of a funny term, but very fitting. But then also this very cerebral work of understanding the ecosystem, understanding the tree, and applying all of this book knowledge you have, but then you have to be able to physically get there. And so that's still a pretty, especially here on the West Coast where the trees are tall, that's still a pretty common thing that people are doing. A lot of other parts of the country, it's going pretty heavily mechanized. So there are some places where tree climbing is sort of becoming a lost art. But I think there will be a lot of settings where people are still routinely climbing trees in this sort of, I don't want to call it old school, just, you know, using ropes and climbing equipment. And then that research work is part of it. And that stuff is really neat because, I mean, sometimes those people are taking just to get their first rope so they can start getting up in the tree. It can be hours or a day of getting a, you know, how do you get a rope 200 feet up a tree from the ground? It's incredible. And then
the old, like, tie it to a tennis ball and throw the tennis ball up your tree in your front yard. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then we obviously in the urban setting, we have some pretty big trees, though typically nothing quite as intensive as what the researchers deal with. But sometimes I put on a harness and I climb 15 feet up a Japanese maple and then just do a little bit of deadwooding. And other days I'm 170 feet up a Douglas fir in somebody's yard in urban Seattle. So it's really varied what we deal with as well, which can be a lot of fun.
What a fun job. Now, I'm curious because today we're talking about a much humbler collection of trees, you know, fruit trees in your backyard for home gardeners that are, you know, never going to get probably bigger than 8 or 9 feet. Where does your passion for fruit trees intertwine with this passion for big, epic trees?
So I think it's about being able to help people with all the trees in the landscape mm-hmm. around them. And then there's just the simple fact that fruit trees often require a bit more care than these large growing trees. It's an interesting dichotomy where, say, you take something like a Douglas fir, this big mature tree. It's really, what is the least that we can do to this tree is generally the best thing, like the absolute most hands-off approach where we're just managing risk or like taking care of a few minor conflicts, say with like a surrounding building or something. Fruit trees, well, they don't have to be on the intensive edge of the spectrum, but many of them are, especially when people really choose to manage them intensely for a home orchard. And so we often just, you know, maybe I might prune a Douglas fir tree once every 5 or 7 years, and some apple trees we're pruning every year. And mm-hmm. we like to help people with all the trees that they have. But I will say it's not the thing that got me into being an arborist, but it's something I've really enjoyed learning more about in the last few years. And then the really special ones that we see here in Seattle is actually a lot of Seattle was farmland. You know, initially it started out as old growth forest. Forestry removed most of that and then transitioned to agriculture before it was suburbs in the city that it is now. And we actually see some of the original orchard trees, which can be in excess of 100 years old. And they're kind of like the old growth version of fruit trees, these really, really charismatic apples and cherries. And I have a real blast working with those. But also when you can work with these trees from a young age, you get a lot more say in how they turn out. You know, an old tree, you can only give it just the littlest nudges this way and that. Whereas a young tree, and we'll talk about this in a sec, but a young tree, you can really do quite a bit to determine what that tree's eventual form will be. And if you do a good job of that, it's going to hopefully make managing that tree long-term much simpler.
Yeah, I feel like particularly with this real surge in interest in home permaculture and food forests and, you know, all of this sustainability and, like, you know, growing your own food to make your life more sustainable as well. This interest in fruit trees is certainly present more probably. I mean, I think always that's so fun to like have a fruit tree in your backyard, but I think definitely more. And also like in urban environments, I mean, last year at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show, I remember one of the garden installs had fruit trees espaliered so that they took up really a really small footprint. And because of that, they were able to have multiples like in this like very pretty row. So there's so much there. It's so cool.
And I think what you just said there like leads us in really well to the fruit tree discussion mm-hmm. because it's almost like we have to reach a fork in the road before you even get started. And the two options there, one is you have a site and you're trying to figure out, is this a good place for me to have fruit trees? Mm-hmm. So in that instance, maybe we want to do a little bit of site assessment and, you know, also just look at what your free time is like and your goals and just see, okay, does this make sense? Where at the site makes sense? And then what species or what cultivars? And then just so that folks know, like species is, you know, that's like saying wolves, right? Cultivar is more like a breed. So mm-hmm. our doofy dogs are still descended of wolves and we have all these breeds of dog, but they can all still interbreed. They're all part of the same species. So hopefully when we say that, folks can remember that a cultivar is just like a dog breed. And then a species is, you know, like comparing dogs and cats.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's the one option. The other option is, okay, I just moved here, like I did with my house here in Seattle. And oh, there's actually 2 prune plums in the backyard. They're mature, they're established. And so it's not like, no. Oh, goodness, do we get some plums some years? So then in that case, it's working with what you have. And you're not, you know, maybe we could always add additional fruit trees if we wanted. And I can do some work to manage and shape those trees. But it's not like I wouldn't have necessarily planted 2 of them, let's just say. So
right, that's a lot of plums. That's a lot of plums.
And actually, we probably encounter that second scenario even more than the first one, just doing our work.
Yeah, I think you also bring up something that's important. Like my brother just bought his first house. They bought it in the winter in Richmond, Virginia. So they didn't realize that one of the trees in their backyard was enormous pear tree. And they were getting hundreds upon hundreds of pears all summer to the point that they couldn't maintain it. The pears were dropping and falling on the floor. His girlfriend was saying how like their backyard would kind of have this acidic smell because the pears were decomposing. Like they couldn't collect the pears fast enough. So I also think like when you're thinking about you know, planting stuff in your backyard, you have to also think about, okay, do you want the fully mature harvest of all the pears or the plums or whatever you're growing? You have to take that into consideration.
So if you're interested in growing fruit trees in your backyard, you're probably also interested in ecological gardening. And that's where I want to recommend a book that just came out. It's called The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening by the American Horticultural Society. And it helps you understand your garden as a living system, soil, plants, water, insects, everything being connected instead of separate, and how small, thoughtful choices can lead to healthier plants and a more resilient garden overall. This book is super practical and comprehensive. Obviously, it's written by people who know what they're talking about. It's by the American Horticultural Society. And what this book really does is it brings a lot of the different topics that we talk about individually on this podcast, like water conservation or leaving the leaves in autumn or organic gardening, and it pulls it all under one roof. So if you've been curious about gardening in a way that's gentler on the planet and more rewarding for you, this is a great place to start. You can grab The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening by the American Horticultural Society wherever books are sold. Once again, that's called The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening by the American Horticultural Society wherever books are sold. Okay, so as we've discussed in today's episode, the secret to happy, healthy, abundant fruit trees starts way before that first fruit actually appears. It starts at planting, and that's where I'm going to encourage you to use Espoma Organic products. When you're planting the tree up, I highly suggest sprinkling some Espoma Organic Biotone Starter Plus plant food in the actual hole that you're putting the tree in. It's going to help support root development and reduce transplant stress, which is a huge deal when you're talking about getting trees established. And then as the tree grows and establishes, you're going to want to feed it. And Espoma has two products that are specifically geared for trees, depending on what you're growing. They have a citrus tone, which is a citrus fertilizer. And then they also have a tree tone, which is a tree fertilizer. So if you're going to be growing citrus trees, avocado trees, some fruit and nut trees, go with citrus tone. And then for shade trees, ornamental trees, and some other backyard fruit trees, you're going to go with their tree tone. Both tones are the names for their fertilizers, are slow release organic plant food that's enhanced with beneficial microbes that support greener foliage, stronger growth, bigger fruits, bigger blooms, and just a better established tree. Obviously, if you need to amend your soil, you should use their incredible composts that they have. They truly have everything you need to grow and set up your best garden yet. So you can head to espoma.com to learn about their wide variety of both indoor and outdoor garden products, potting mixes, garden soils, fertilizers, composts, the works, and enjoy supporting a family-owned and operated company that's been around for over 90 years that makes organic products that are safe for people, pets, and the planet. You can learn more at espoma.com, or if you want, you can go to my curated Espoma collection in my Amazon storefront, where I've curated all of my favorite Espoma products that you can browse.
Absolutely. And so that's why, first of all, I think it's good for folks to know that it's okay to have what I essentially would call a shade tree that happens to produce fruit. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you're mentioning with the pears there, it is a lot of work cleaning up fallen fruit, but otherwise it's pretty hands off. And then either with a ladder or a picker or just reaching up to the low branches, often you can get quite a bit of good fruit from a tree like that. Mm-hmm. So just folks should know, like, that's okay. If you're getting enough fruit to keep you happy, if the fruit is decent quality, just don't feel like you have to do anything. Anything you do will just be to keep from having, say, like pest issues surrounding the fruit or Everyone loves. I was a little busy last summer and my yard smelled like fermenting plums for a while. So I think that's how we figured out about that's. Oh, gosh, I read the most fascinating thing a while ago that our ape ancestors were actually developed the gene. One of the reasons humans can tolerate alcohol better than other mammals is because our ancestors evolved to be able to eat fallen fruit. I mean, that provided an extra energy source. And so that pushed us towards evolving a greater ability to metabolize alcohol than other mammals that wouldn't eat that fallen fruit. So it's like, man, this is so deep. This is so deep in our evolutionary history.
When you mentioned like having an orchard, What's the difference between when does something become a backyard orchard? Is there a number of trees that, you know, if it's two plums, it's just that I have two plum trees in my backyard. But if I have, you know, 12 trees, it's an orchard. Like, because I think a lot of people talk about how they want a backyard orchard, but like, what does that require?
So I don't like rules. Nature doesn't either. I don't come up with rules for these things. I would just say if you have a tree and it makes fruit, you can call it an orchard. Don't get too mad at it.
So I
think that the big thing for folks to know is that there are some trees that are self-fertile. Like fig is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. You know, we have the tree's going to flower in the spring. Trees are going to try to pollinate each other, typically with the assistance of native pollinators, sometimes non-native honeybees as well. But in the absence of that fertilization, many trees just aren't going to fruit. And even the ones that are self-fertile typically will have an improved quality of fruit if they're fertilized by an outside tree. Mm-hmm. So in theory, with some of these species, one tree won't be an orchard because you won't get any fruit unless you have nearby trees. And so I think that's like a big urban-rural divide. In the urban area, like here in Seattle, there are so many fruit trees in so many yards. You're just going to get fertilization. The biggest thing there is going to be weather conditions. Like if it's really cold for the week or two that the tree is in bloom, you just might not have the pollinators out doing their work. And so the flowers aren't pollinated and you therefore don't get fruit. Like this is the number one. So many people think the pruning is the big thing. No, it's pollination. It's fertilization is the critical factor in fruit production. And you have to have nearby trees to provide that. And with some trees, it's very general. With other trees, I mean, there's like with cherry trees, they'll say, oh, you need this cultivar to fertilize that cultivar. And it gets extremely specific. So that's the biggest thing I would say there about, you know, do you have an orchard? I think to have an orchard, you need to have trees that are being fertilized. And if you live way out in the woods somewhere, that might require that you plant both kinds of trees or multiples of the same species. Whereas if you're in an urban area, you can probably just plant one tree and then some neighbor's tree is going to help fertilize it. So hopefully that helps.
No, for sure. That's so helpful to point out. And it seems like a lot of growers are trying to solve that problem. Like I think on Instagram today, I was watching some video that was talking about edible plants. And there was one plant that had a male and a female vine in the same pot so that if you planted it together, ideally you would be getting pollination. Because so many people, I think, don't understand, like, you know, if you buy a blueberry bush, like you need more than one, you know, or if you buy, you know, a non-self-fertile tree, you do have to get a little strategic about what you're planting around it.
And these are all things we already know, right? They're things that we understand intuitively, especially when dealing with animals, is that you just want genetic diversity in the process of sexual reproduction. So it's really just that, but applied to trees and plants, right? So we need female tree part, we need a male tree part, and we need them to love each other very much. Ideally, there's good genetic diversity there, and that's how we're going to get the healthiest offspring, which is going to include fruit. But, you know, and then also just keeping in mind that like the point of this for the tree is not the fleshy fruit. The fleshy fruit is the enticement for some animal to move the seeds to another location. You know, it could be a bird, it could be a mammal. It's just incredible symbiotic relationship. You know, first the tree is giving nectar to the pollinators to entice them to fly around and do the pollination work. And then the tree is giving calories to various birds and other animals in return for the promise of moving those seeds, usually through their digestive tract. So just think about like what's in it for the tree. And now through often centuries to millennia of humans sort of taking over some of that process and pushing trees towards greater production, we have these fruit that often get very, very fleshy and don't resemble as much what we would have found in nature. Like for instance, crab apple is a lot more like what you would find a native apple tree looking like, which is like a lot of seed relative to the amount of fruit you get. But just through, I mean, that's the same way that you get domestic dogs from wolves, is just selective breeding over hundreds of generations can result in some pretty incredible changes to the population.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. Hopefully that just helps people like conceptualize what is going on here.
Yeah. I also think it would be helpful to talk about timeline, because I do feel like for gardeners who are used to growing their tomatoes and their potatoes and their peppers and herbs, you know, the timeline and the investment that you're looking at for a fruit tree is different than that tomato that you're going to plant in May and you're going to get fruit in July, right? So realistically, if I'm thinking about putting a fruit tree or two in my backyard, how long does it need to establish before it's fruiting? Like, when am I going to see fruit versus when I'm planting?
Yeah. And so that's a great question. It'll depend what you're planting and how far along it is. Mm-hmm. Most trees are coming from nurseries, and it's like a small start that's attached to a rootstock. And folks, mm-hmm. it also helps to know that a lot of times the rootstock is genetically distinct from the portion you're growing above the ground. They're grafted together and they're going to work together for the entire lifespan of the tree. But that's how we get things like, you know, say you like have a Gravenstein apple grafted to a dwarf rootstock. That's how we get things like that. It's also how we get multi-way fruit trees, which we'll sort of touch on later. I'm not the biggest fan of those, but very few people are actually planting fruit trees from seed. So say you take an apple seed, you stick it in the ground. Realistically, we're looking at like 6 to 10 years before you see an apple. Mm-hmm. If you plant something from the nursery and it's like a little start on a grafted rootstock.
Tree or something. Yeah,
exactly. You're probably looking at more like 3 to 6 years. And that actually goes really well into like where is the fruit on the tree. And this will vary based on species, you know, on the shorter end of the spectrum. And it's like, what age of wood is the fruit growing on? So mm-hmm. just think about it that we have like current year's growth. So imagine it's like July right now. Current year's growth is like what just popped out of the tree a few months ago. 1 year old growth is the stuff that grew 1 year before. 2 year old growth is 2 years before. So what age of wood the tree is going to fruit on is actually a really big factor in determining where and how to prune it. And then a lot of these trees that we're dealing with, like plums and apples, it's like 2 to 4 year old wood. So you have to have grown the tree for at least that many years to even have the possibility of getting fruit. And in addition, you also need the tree to be fertilized, and it needs to also just feel like it has the resources to devote to reproduction.
That's very interesting.
I want to be careful and not get sucked too far down the rabbit hole on these species specific things.
Yeah.
But like my critical point there would just be like trees will fruit on wood of different ages. And then for folks to think about it, it's like, okay, that core of the tree always stays where it is. And trees are always growing additively a little bit at a time, either in circumference or in length from the branch end. So nothing ever actually moves. We just keep adding more to the outside.
So maybe for the purposes of this conversation, we should hone in on like what fruit we're talking about. So what, in your opinion, especially because you interact with clients all the time, what are the most popular fruit trees that people are putting in their backyards in? We'll just keep it to the United States. Obviously, that's a lot of zones. But what are you seeing? Obviously, apples.
So here in Seattle, I'd say the three most common are apple, plum, and fig. But we, you know, as we were talking before we started this conversation, we can grow so many things here. It's just incredible. We have this just amazingly long growing season, rich soils, lots of moisture, and then actually a pretty warm and dry summer, which can really help a lot of these fruit trees come along. And mm-hmm. so it's like, it's this huge crossover of various things that work. And for people in other parts of the country, they're going to have to be a lot more cautious, I think, about what works in their zone and what can handle their winter and what can handle their summer. So we do get a bit spoiled here in Seattle, where, you know, you can see everything. I have customers that have a few olives that like actually get olives from their olive trees. And then, you know, we grow Alaska yellow cedar here as well, which is a tree that you would typically find on like the BC coast or the Alaska panhandle. These like really hardy northern trees can also grow here. It's a really incredible place. And so I think for us here in Seattle, those would be the primary ones that we see. And I'll sort of tailor some of what I'm saying to those three species just because that's what I'm most familiar with.
Yeah, I'm in mango territory. My neighbors have mango trees in their front yards.
That's amazing. It's
so crazy. And like, I know so many people who are like, yeah, I bought this house and there was a 30-year-old mango tree, or my neighbor has a mango tree that grows over into my backyard. So I just get the mangoes and I'm like, where am I living? This is so crazy. And I have a coconut tree in my backyard. So that's a whole nother thing too.
Oh my goodness.
But well, I realize I don't get to relate to my audience anymore in the way that I used to when I lived in New York. So I realize we won't talk about those on the conversation today. Just to be clear, what you were just saying, though, I think is really interesting. So the fruit is going to, the flower that turns into the fruit is going to grow on older growth, and that's species specific. So that's up to you to Google what year growth do apple blossoms blossom on or mango blossoms blossom on? Like, is that how you're figuring that out?
Yeah. And this is where I'll take a moment to plug WSU here in Washington State. They have some really terrific resources that, you know, obviously still a bit more tailored to the Pacific Northwest and our needs. But a number of these states, especially here in Washington, the orchard industry is really big. It's a multi-million dollar export industry, really, really a big deal. And the state has opted to devote a lot of resources to supporting them, which is really terrific. And the nice thing is that they take all that expertise and then they translate it into documents that are more oriented towards home gardeners. So we can really benefit from an incredible amount of knowledge and expertise on this sort of more commercial and industrial scale. And then we can scale down a lot of that to what works in people's yards. And I would just encourage folks to start with their extension services in their state. And I'm sure it'll vary state by state. I bet in Florida, there's tons of resources for citrus growing because that's such a big deal there. But I know where I'm from in New Hampshire, fruit trees just aren't that big of a thing. And we have a lot of berries that do really well, but you just don't get a lot of fruit up in like northern New England that is really successful. So that would be the first logical starting place. And then just knowledgeable local nurseries. What nurseries have in stock should generally be the things that work well in your region. And the staff at a good nursery are going to be able to point you in the right direction. Yes. And help get you a tree that's going to work well. Whereas, you know, if you're into some big box store, they may just get the same stuff that all the other big box stores get. And that may not be something that's actually going to grow super well in your area, or it might be something that's a little bit more of a fad. So I think that's the best advice I have for folks there.
Yeah, I'm learning that lesson so hard right now because I moved from zone 5B to zone 10B last year. And this has been my first year gardening down here. And it's literally all new plants. Like, I don't recognize anything that any of my neighbors have in their yards. I am leaning on the local nurseries so much. Like, I don't go to the big box stores as much as I used to because I could trust my knowledge, you know, in upstate New York. But here I'm like, no, I'm going to the nursery when I know no one else is going to be there. And I'm monopolizing the lady's time at the nursery because I know that she's growing this. And it's so amazing. It's such a valuable resource that often gets overlooked. So what do we need to know when planting up fruit trees?
And actually, let me just go back for one second, because you asked a question I didn't answer, which is like, what is the time investment throughout the year look like?
Okay.
The big thing that you're not going to have control over is harvest. So harvest is going, the fruit is going to ripen when the tree is darn well ready for it to ripen. And then it's going to fall off when the tree is ready for it to fall off. And it doesn't matter if you've got a lot going on that week or not. That's when that has to happen. Mm-hmm. But the good news is much of the rest of the work can go on a bit more on your schedule. So winter pruning is typically done in the winter for most of these species after the frost risk has passed. Some trees are pruned in the late summer if they have certain fungal problems that will be improved by pruning them at that time. But the most general guideline is that pruning happens in the winter after frost risk has passed, which Seattle gets like a frost every other year. So a lot of our trees, we just prune them whenever in the winter. So that's the big one. I mean, we have planting will also typically happen in the winter, or same thing sort of after the frost risk has passed in the spring. But before we get too far along, you only have to do that once. And then there is sometimes some treatment work that you do have to be, you have to be time sensitive on. We don't want to get into treatment too much today, but I'll just say like anything you put on that tree, remember, you're going to be potentially consuming. So things like physical barriers, like here in Seattle, we have a lot of problems with apple maggot. So people actually just put nets over their apple tree and keep the adult insect out from ever laying its eggs on the developing fruit. And that just sort of has to happen when the fruit's at the right stage. And if you miss that window, you're out of luck. So it's really harvest, I think, that is the big one and just kind of has to happen. And then there's some tactics there, like my wife has just pureed and then frozen our plums before so that she can deal with doing jam and everything later. But she still had to do that part of the process at that time or things are going to spoil. So, I mean, the beautiful thing about how natural all this is that there's no preservative. So you just have to work on that natural timeline.
Totally. We have tons of podcast episodes, too, for people interested in learning how to preserve your garden harvests. Like scroll the feed. We've got plenty of episodes on canning and jarring and dehydrating and all those good things. We still have apple chips that my husband made from apple harvests from our friends like 2 years ago when we still lived in the Catskills. So yeah, but I think it's important to understand if you buy a fruit tree in the spring at your garden center when it's time to plant up your garden, like don't expect that you're getting fruit that year. This is a long-term, slow burn investment, right?
Yeah. And also it just helps, I think, for folks to know that planting and transplant, especially for trees, is a bit of a traumatic process. The smaller the tree is when you get it, the smaller the tree is at planting, generally the faster it gets through that. We would call it transplant shock. And then especially to do a good job of planting, often you have to do a lot of processing of the roots, taking off nursery soil, straightening the roots out. If anything, to do a good job planting, you're often increasing the stress level for the tree. But if you don't do that and say the roots are just circling in the container and you're afraid you don't want to hurt the tree, actually you're really harming that tree's long-term prospects because those roots may just keep going in a circle.
In the ground once you plant them.
Exactly. And I sometimes pull failed trees out of the ground and you can literally see the pot it came in. And some of these trees just suffered along for like 10 years before they either died or we finally gave up on them. So that's the big thing is like just... Let me see. Just be thinking of like, this is a long-term investment. The longer this tree is in the ground and established, the more likely it is to give you a nice fruit crop. And it's trees. Nothing happens quickly with trees. We have this big mismatch between how humans experience time and how trees experience time. I mean, think of the redwoods from the book you're reading, right? A year to them is probably like a day to us.
100%. And that's beautiful, right? Because that's where heritage comes and that's why so many people buy homes that have fruit trees in their backyard. They don't have tomato plants. They have fruit trees because that is the beauty of the longevity of this practice. So what are some general rules of thumb for planting? Are you obviously, you know, if the tree comes in that burlap or, you know, whatever it's coming in from the nursery, removing that, like you said, straightening the roots. Are you planting with any type of nutrients in the soil? How big is the hole you're putting it in? All those good things.
Yeah. Great. All great questions. We're typically trying to start small just because there's less that can go wrong. The smaller the specimen is. And nursery trees typically are not available in larger sizes. You know, for instance, some people want a really large Japanese maple to get started and they can find one. But even with those ornamental trees, it's still better to start small, both financially and also for tree health. We're very fortunate here in Seattle that we have generally quite nutrient rich soils. So we're almost never having to amend, though. What I tell folks there is just before you put anything in your soil other than arborist wood chip mulch, the one thing you can be sure won't ever hurt and always helps, do a soil test. You know, it's very easy to add too much and then not be able to get it back out of various nutrients. And it's also easy for toxicities to look like deficiencies. So just don't put anything in your soil without running a test and just see, again, talk to folks, read your resources, see, okay, maybe these are things. A lot of places folks do need to change pH a little, maybe with lime, but we're very lucky here in Seattle. Things just seem to grow. So typically the hole is a bit larger than the root ball that the tree comes with just because you're trying to mix up soil. And just think about it. It's like the more even the soil is, the more those tree roots are surrounded by the soil in the site. You're not adding anything special. If you give the tree its own special little bit of topsoil, that's going to discourage the roots from growing into the surrounding site soil. You just want whatever soil came out of the hole goes back in the hole, mixed with the roots nicely. And that's that. Cover over with a nice 4-inch layer of arborist wood chips. Those are going to slowly add nutrients to the soil, but critically, they're going to act as an insulator. And that essentially should be what's under every tree you have if you're willing to do it, because that's just helping to improve the soils and act like the organic layer we would find in the forest. And then once you do that, you only add support to the tree if you're worried about it falling over. And then in some of these pruning systems like espalier, you have very specific sort of support you're adding to the tree. But that I'd say those are the main things. And then watering is really critical for the first couple of years as the tree establishes its root system. And so I always break down the difference between there's watering to establishment, which is like that first 1 to 3 years, you're giving the tree occasional deep soakings, often like once a week after you've planted it. That is very different from just perpetual irrigation. You know, say you plant some tree and it just has much higher water needs than your climate will support. And that's maybe a tree that has to be watered forever. So watering to establishment is fine. We just need to do it with any of these trees we plant. And then I discourage folks from planting trees that are just going to need perpetual water. None of the fruit trees I know of are like that, but certain species in certain sites, maybe.
Okay. So make sure that you're deep watering and those roots are staying nice and moist in the soil so that they can keep growing and, you know, establishing themselves. In terms of light, I mean, obviously light is going to be very specific per species, but I would assume, are we mostly planting our backyard orchards in full sun all day?
Yeah. So another great question. And let's think through, where are we siting this tree, right? And again, it's going to be somewhat species specific. For instance, I mentioned figs. We have figs commonly around here. Some of them will grow a little fruit late in the summer and the fruit never quite ripens because it's not quite warm enough for that cultivar. Other figs, either because their site is warmer so that the fruit does fully develop, or because of some difference in the cultivar, they'll put on two full crops of figs that both ripen. Mm. So there can be some really interesting like microsite stuff going on there. But just generally, when a tree is growing in a forest, it has to devote a lot of resources to either just staying alive in a darkened spot if it has neighbors that are competing for light. You know, say you have these big trees growing around you. Yep. A lot of times, like, you're just going to focus on, like, I'm trying to get up to the canopy and all my energy is going there and I will worry about reproduction later. Mm-hmm. So then when we create an orchard, often we've removed at some point, us or our predecessors have removed the forest that was once there. And now these trees aren't having to compete for access to sunlight. And so instead, they have a lot of energy to devote towards fruiting. And that's how we get these incredible fruit crops. So typically, it's going to be full sun. I'd encourage folks to, when possible, just work with what you have. You know, maybe you plant in the sunnier part of your yard. And then another part of your yard, things are a bit shadier. We have this lovely affordable housing development planned near us, and they want to do food gardening, and they're right next to a transmission, like a power line transmission corridor. And it's like, oh, this is great. You're going to be in a native forest habitat with a lot of shade. And then like 300 yards away, you could have these incredible food gardens in a place where we're never going to be able to grow large native shade trees. So to me, it seems like such a great way to combine the two. Whereas if we're cutting down native shade trees to create space for this orchard, maybe ecologically, that's not a sound decision. So yeah. I think just looking at the site as a whole, and you know, it's just funny. I always remind people, I'm like, you know, solar panels are kind of the thing right now. Trees, just every leaf is a little solar panel. The tree's trying to make energy. And we just have to remember that there's always going to be this competition for space and for sunlight. And that's essentially what a forest is. It's just trees competing for space and sunlight. So yeah, often these sunny spots in the yard are going to be the ones that make the most sense. And then I would say, just think about access. Usually orchards are on relatively flat ground. If you're on some steep hillside, it could be a lot harder to maintain the tree and to care for it in the long term. So somewhere, if you're going to use a ladder, and if you use any ladder, it should be a specialty orchard ladder with a nice wide base. Mm-hmm. They're just called orchard ladders. They have a third leg that sticks out. But I would strongly recommend folks to, if they have the chance and the opportunity, to keep their trees small enough that they don't need ladders, because ladders are pretty dangerous. So just finding those nice, flat, sunny spots where you don't have a whole lot else going on and you want to plant a fruit tree and maintain it there, then, you know, we can then sort of roll this right into how are we actually caring for this tree that we planted. Yeah. But, you know, especially if you have the luxury of establishing a tree from a young age, you can typically, through pruning, just say like, okay, this tree is not getting taller than 8 feet. And I can tell you, having climbed some 35 or 40 foot tall apple trees, they're a lot easier when they're 8 feet tall.
Right. To harvest from, for sure. So why is pruning so important with fruit trees? Feels like it's more important than with other edible plants that we grow.
Well, and it's funny, right? Because it's like, why do we prune? And as I mentioned earlier, you can have an unpruned fruit tree that produces plenty of fruit. It can be healthy. Mm-hmm. It can have a great fruit crop. The big thing is that the fruit crop is going to be way up there. Mm-hmm. And so typically the pruning is to keep the fruit accessible. Then there is an element of just like kind of thinning the canopy can help both the fruit develop a little bit better. And then sometimes you're actually getting like fewer fruit, but of a higher quality. But I do think, and this is so often what we run into with pruning, like pruning is about us. Without humans, there's no tree pruning. And without humans, there's no forestry. So it's virtually always for some reason that has to do with us. Mm-hmm. And so keeping fruit accessible, keeping the size of the tree down so that it works in the space, that is usually one of the primary objectives of pruning. And then trying to have a nice, healthy harvest, keeping the tree, say it's near a house, maybe you're pruning it back from the house, just so that it's not dropping fruit in your gutters or hurting your roof. Those are also really good reasons to prune the tree. But just maintaining a smaller size and keeping the fruit accessible is probably like the number one reason folks would want to prune a tree.
And you're pruning in the spring, and that's going to trigger the growth that comes on in the growing season?
Again, it's fascinating. So generally, fruit trees are very tolerant of pruning, because if they weren't, we wouldn't have cultivated them as fruit trees. And anytime you cut live material, live tissue off of a tree, you're taking away an energy investment that tree made to grow that tissue. Mm-hmm. So in essence, all pruning of live material is a stress. It's just that fruit trees are really, really probably better than any other kind of tree able to withstand that stress. Mm-hmm. And so we do prune during dormancy because that's a time of the year when it's less stressful for the tree. All those nutrients that they had in the leaves have been stored in the trunk and the roots for the winter, the energy that those leaves had them in them as well. And so that's typically why, and when I say dormancy, I just mean when the leaves are off. Anytime, mm-hmm. you know, you would see a deciduous tree without leaves. And so that's taking less resources from the tree. And then when that tree comes out of dormancy in the spring, it's usually going to go, hey, wow, there's a lot of sunlight here. I should grow some new shoots to capitalize on this sunlight and fill myself back in. And that's what the tree is trying to do when it grows. You know, often they'll grow from the ends of the branches, maybe some internal branches will fill out more. And then a lot of times we get these things called, people usually call them water sprouts, which is like a branch that appears from somewhere where there wasn't any branch before. And that's just like cells in the trunk that are sensing sunlight and going, oh, we should grow a branch here because there's some sunlight. Trees are just trying to harvest the sunlight, right? And so we sort of, in essence, we sort of artificially stress them and take resources from them to keep them small. Like, it sounds mean, right? But it's something that's really common with all of these trees. And in a more natural setting, they would be, their growth would be somewhat suppressed. It would just be by their neighbors shading them, right, instead of by somebody coming along and pruning them. So we sort of like artificially give them more resources than they would naturally have. And then we artificially take some of those resources away to try to keep them from getting too huge. Mm-hmm. But it's all in service of, right, keep the fruit accessible, have high quality fruit. And it's this symbiotic relationship that we have with the tree. I mean, it's not unlike the relationship I have with my dog, where it's like, hey, you give me companionship, I give you kibbles, right?
Right. It's a good deal. So that first year, if you plant your tree and it grows and it flowers while it's still establishing, is there ever a practice of like removing the blooms to encourage the tree to just keep growing roots and establishing? Or once you plant it and give it its prune in the spring, you plant it in the winter, give it its prune in the spring, you kind of just like let it do its thing. Is there any management of the blossoms? I guess that's the question I'm asking.
So I have heard of some people that on a more mature tree will pull off some of the developing fruit to improve the quality of the remaining developing fruit. Mm-hmm. I've never heard of anyone being quite that involved. And that's part of it too. It's like, I want folks to know that like, look, you don't, this is not a super involved pursuit. I'm really good at making things overly complex, but like you get the thing in the ground and then forget about it for 2 or 3 years. Just water it.
It's a long-term play. Okay.
Things are going to happen relatively slowly. As long as it doesn't dry out those first summer or two and die, it's probably going to be just fine, especially if you started small and at a tree that at planting, there's just not likely to be a lot that goes wrong with. And then what you're going to do is one of two things will happen. Either it will just start fruiting on its own, or it'll reach a size where you're starting to think about pruning and managing it. And that management, you know, I mean, that's the essence, right? We've taken 47 minutes to get here, but like fruit tree pruning. Mm-hmm. So it's pruning and it's training. And the big difference there is pruning is cutting, training is manipulating. So a lot of times training is something as simple as like sticking a brace in between two branches to open up a little bit of space so that as those branches mature, they're a little bit stronger. And I won't get too far into that today, but it's also similar to what folks are doing in espalier when they're pulling a branch down to a wire, mm-hmm. tying it off for a couple of years. And then when they remove that attachment to the wire, the branch will stay put. Mm-hmm. So you can actually do a lot through training, but typically at some point you're going to have to start pruning. And the two are typically done in tandem. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've got that tree, it's getting a little bit bigger and we're starting to prune to establish its form. And it's just like there are a lot of good resources for how to look at each individual species of tree and what sort of form you ideally want to shoot for. But it's typically just like we want some nice, strong, woody stems here that can hold the weight of fruit as the tree ages. And we want to do our size control. And we just want to make sure we're preserving enough branches of that aging, that age that produces fruit, to make sure that we're going to have a nice fruit crop. And we have to remember that we have to let some branches grow, because if we don't, we're eventually not going to have anything putting out fruit. So right. I think like the
of like, are you pruning a third of the tree or a third of the branches, or are you pruning mostly everything?
Well, let's take apple, for example.
Okay.
Some folks will go through and prune all those water sprouts off every year. And usually they're retaining enough lower, older branches that they'll get some fruiting down there. Mm-hmm. But then the tree also, in response to that really intensive removal of water sprouts, will typically grow even more water sprouts than if you'd say left half of them and just every other year, you know, say every year you remove half of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of have this overlay where you're not always, you know, just removing all of them from the tree. That can actually reduce the amount of maintenance you have to do to some degree. But yeah, I think that's like, and then certainly with other trees, the most intensive pruning tends to come when the tree has gotten a lot bigger than you planned on. And then maybe we make a decision to do what I'll call a restructuring. And we have to make some really aggressive woody cuts to get the size back down. Often that will result in diminished fruit for a couple of years. But then if we work with the regrowth, you know, once we have, say it's an apple again, once you hit like 2 or 3 years in that regrowing branch that's come off the big woody cut, we should start to see fruiting again. So it's always better to stay on top of it annually. The pruning dose or the amount that we do every year on fruit trees, it's often ranging, you know, very frequently it's more than a quarter of the total live foliage. I mean, frankly, sometimes it's in the ballpark of like a half, which is like, that's crazy stuff for like any, you know, we would never do that to a Japanese maple. We'd never do it to a Douglas fir. It's just that these fruit trees are typically uniquely tolerant of pruning. Because of their domestication. But, so it's pretty heavy, but it'll be really dependent, especially talking to an audience of people that aren't just in the Northwest.
Yeah.
It's going to be really dependent on what species of tree you're growing and then what zone you're growing it in. And it's always going to be a response to what growth the tree has given you. So that's like your first measure. It's just how fast, how rapidly is this tree growing? And then you sort of scale your pruning upwards or downwards based on that. And the other nice thing I'll tell the people is like, you're going to make mistakes. It takes a while to get this figured out, and you can read all the books in the world and it won't teach you perfectly how to do it. So the thing is, especially because they're such tough and forgiving trees, you just do your work and you see how the tree responds. And yeah. You learn so quickly in dealing with... So I've been an arborist for 15 years. Some of the big old trees I've worked on, I'm only now figuring out how they responded. Like trees I worked on early in my career.
Right, because it takes time.
Because it takes so much time. And it's like, I'm only going to get better, but often, you know, hopefully I will work on trees that were alive before I was born and alive after I'm dead. How do you really learn how what you're doing is impacting that tree? At least as trees grow, fruit trees are on the complete other end of the spectrum. You get such rapid response to the things that you do. It gives you this tremendous opportunity to learn year after year. Whereas like, you know, say I prune a Western red cedar today, those can live for 1500 years. How do I know what I did impact that tree in 200 or 300 years. I'll never know. So I'm just having to do my best to make an informed guess on what'll happen. But I'll never actually know.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. What are the top mistakes you see beginners make?
I think safety is just a really big one that we should discuss. Like just watch out for ladders. If you're going to be on one, have it be an orchard ladder on firm ground. Don't hesitate to have somebody hold it for you. It's just not worth getting hurt working on your fruit tree. And arborists can sure sound expensive, but nothing's more expensive than the American healthcare system. So, you know, $100 to a good arborist could be the cheapest, you know, the best deal you've ever gotten if we compare it to a trip to the ER. So just don't be afraid to ask for help. And then just, you know, wear your safety glasses. It's really easy to reach into a tree and not see a stick that's coming at your eye.
Okay.
It's really easy to poke your eye while you're pruning the tree. And then you're working with these, I mean, tree wood is a lot tougher than your skin. We're working with tools, usually the two tools I use most of the time is just a good old set of hand pruners, like Felco hand pruners, and then a hand saw. I really like Silky. And they are both as sharp as can be. So we have to be really careful. I wear gloves and I'm just very cautious about, you know, say, I make sure if I cut through something, the saw is not going to come in contact with me after it. I think the safety, because for all this other stuff, like, yes, we want to have nice fruit production, but just be careful and don't hurt yourself.
Don't lose a finger over your apple tree. Not worth it.
And the thing that really helps, what's that?
Especially with those pruners. My mom
almost
cut her pointer finger off with a pruner.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And the saws, too, they're just really, really a good saw should be really sharp, and sharp tools are safer than dull tools. But also, if you come in contact with any tool, but especially a sharp one, it can be really damaging. And then the other thing that helps there is just long reach pickers or pole tools. So that's where you keep your feet firmly on the ground It's hard to fall off a ladder if you're not on one. And then you're reaching up over your head. At some point, you probably want head protection, but mostly if you're just picking or doing small work. I wear a helmet at work because it's legally required and it's just a good idea, but that's getting pretty intense for the home orchardist. But just if you can keep your feet on the ground, it's a big arm workout to use these pole tools, but it keeps you a lot safer. And then I'd say for other mistakes, yes, usually you're going to plant that tree and not do much for the first year or two and just let it devote resources to root growth. But then young formative pruning is often pretty intense and folks will often be a bit hesitant to do as much as is actually needed for that early formative work because they're just worried about the tree. But it's a lot like with humans, young trees, young people are a lot more tolerant of surgery than as we get older. So it's really those older, more established trees that we have to be more cautious and sometimes more gentle with, even with the increased pruning tolerance for fruit trees. And then it's younger trees. And it's just because of this ratio of like how many leaves you have to how much like wood and roots you have. And in the young trees, that there's just not that much like structure to maintain, not that much many branches, not that much trunk, not that many roots relative to like, there's all this sugar coming in. Just imagine like you have a really small house and a high income. It's easy to maintain. And then as the tree gets older, the house gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And often the income will at a certain point just sort of level off. And you can imagine how if you have a really big house, but a somewhat limited income, you know, if something happens to that income, it's a lot more consequential. So just not being aggressive enough with young trees. And then I think those are probably the big ones.
We just bought our first house and, the owner had the house for 30 years and the neighbor's tree has grown such a large, it's not a branch, it's an extra tree trunk that is just over our house to the point that like, it was really hard to get home insurance because of this tree. And I do think it's like, you have to keep your eyeballs, you have to keep your eyes on these trees because now, you know, hopefully our neighbor will handle it, but like this removal of this branch is going to be extremely extensive. Whereas it would have been so much easier to deal with maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah. I'm very curious to see how that all shakes out.
And it's funny because as an arborist, I run into those situations all the time. I would have loved to have helped you prune that branch 25 years ago, except I wasn't an arborist at that point yet. And it would have been probably some small directional cuts, some cuts to suppress growth. And then we encourage other parts of the tree to grow and overshadow that branch that's not the one we really want. Maybe then it even comes off at some point. But it's when things get really established, especially as they fill out in diameter, it just gets more and more consequential to the tree, both in terms of how much foliage it's losing when the branch is removed, but also the wounds just get harder and harder to seal on the tree's part as they get larger. Oh, and that's another really good thing. A lot of folks will ask about like wound paint, wound sealers, that sort of thing. We're typically not using those. We haven't really found anything that works better than just the tree's natural processes. So just nice, clean cuts. And then just looking up, actually, it's University of Florida has some really good resources. There's this fellow, Ed Gilman, and he's written a lot of texts on the pruning and care of trees. And he just goes into there's only three kinds of pruning cuts. There's a removal cut, which is just like cutting a whole branch off. There's a reduction cut, which is cutting a branch back. I don't have a good example here, but it's cutting a branch back to a side branch or a lateral branch that's one third as big as the one you cut off. So in that instance, it's like, okay, the tree is like, all right, I'm going to send the growth here into this branch we saved. Because there's a lot of stuff going on hormonally in the tree that's telling sort of different parts of the tree to grow in different ways. And then the last one is called a heading cut, which a lot of people would think of as like, oh, you just like cut the branch off in the middle and it's this ugly stub. It can also be cutting back to some like little bud or really small lateral branch. You often will end up using those in fruit tree pruning. If you can avoid them, it's nice to, but it is really common in fruit tree pruning. But heading cuts are where you get the most intensive sprouting from, because without that lateral branch to sort of direct the growth of the tree, that's where the tree will often then throw those sprouts out and just say, ooh, I got a big injury here. Let me grow some branches back. And that sprouting growth is just not as organized as the original growth was, because the original growth had more hormonal control is almost the right way to say it. But like, trees are incredible. They've just got all these, there's no central nervous system directing the flow of things, but there's all these chemical signals where the tree is communicating with itself, and that's how it's directing growth. And then when we make cuts, it's just important to know that between how we impact these chemical signals and where we leave growth, which is typically, you know, where we leave a lot of leaves is where there's going to be growth. Those are the two big things that'll impact how the tree responds to pruning.
Okay, that's really helpful. Also, I don't know, I'm just putting two and two together, but I feel like people aren't as interested in trees as they are in gardens that are like, that give you something, right? So fruit trees could be the gateway drug for people to become more passionate about trees in general, because you will see those prunes heal. Like you will see, and you'll get fruit from it, which is amazing. But it is a great like entry option into the world of forestry and trees in general, which are a different ballgame than our herbs and, you know, flowers and all of the things that a lot of gardeners, you know, are more fluent in. So do you personally have a favorite fruit tree?
It's got to be my old plums in the backyard.
Yeah. Just,
they're charismatic. You know, they've got a bunch of heartwood decay, so they're all hollow, which is fine for a lot of these older trees. Like, they actually grow these huge chicken of the woods mushrooms, like every year, every other year, which is actually one of the better eating mushrooms out there. It's a really delicious mushroom. So I know that like the mushrooms are working away on the inside of those trees, and we're just seeing the fruiting body here and there. And I'm just, they're only like 15 feet tall. You know, if one of them falls over, it's not going to hurt anything. But they're just such like, they're such great old characters. And then the fruit that they, when they're in production, it's like we're giving fruit to all our friends, all of our neighbors, and then we still can't use it all. So it's it's fun to be able to be really generous with people, and to just, just to see something. It's like, this came from our house.
Yeah. Who doesn't want that, right? Like, who doesn't want a homegrown plum? Or like, there are, you know, sometimes the neighbors will just put like, you know, boxes of mangoes out, because when mangoes are in season, you know, you can't pay people to take them off your hands.
Yeah. I'm very lucky too that my wife is very crafty with the, she gets all the credit for jams and the plum torts. And then she even made a really successful plum wine at one point. It's like a really fun gift to give at a party is like, we made this wine out of a tree at our house.
That's so cool.
She gets all the credit there and I get none of it for that part.
I love that. That is so cool. Well, you are such a, you're such a knowledge base, and you have your own company. So tell us what you do in the Seattle area, if there are listeners there who might need an arborist, and where people can find you.
Thank you. So the website I can be found at is just conservationtreecare.com. It's a company that I started back in 2018. And we have a strong focus on preserving trees. And we help folks both residentially and also in commercial settings manage trees. And it's just all about helping trees coexist with people and people coexist with trees. A lot of that just looks like simple tree pruning, but we get to do some really neat preservation projects. We help a lot of people with fruit trees. Helping people plant trees is a real passion of ours as well. And so we're pretty small scale. There's just like six of us, and we're based in South Seattle, and we help people throughout the Seattle area and a few of the surrounding municipalities. But unfortunately, we can't travel that far to help people. But yeah, if anyone's interested.
You have some pretty sick photos on your website of like.
Thank you.
The pruning tab on your website, everybody. see how high up it. There was this like epic ficus that you were pruning indoors. And I was like, that is crazy.
That could be an entire hour long interview, but those are actually the ficus trees inside the Amazon spheres.
Yeah.
And those trees are incredible. We prune them twice a year and give them a pretty stout pruning dose. They just grow and grow and grow. So it's really incredible to have developed a relationship with a rainforest tree here in Seattle. But yeah, that's a discussion for another day.
I know. I've been so lucky. I've been there twice, and those spheres are unlike I've ever, nothing like anything I've ever seen before. It's so wild. But yeah, if they're growing at the top of the sphere, they've got like unobstructed views of the sky. And those ficus, if they get the light that they need, they grow like crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also in the spheres, a lot of it too is the plantings under the trees are just as big a part of what's going on there as the trees themselves. So part of it is like they can only get so big, and that the glass sphere isn't getting any larger. So we have to make sure that they continue to fit in there and don't overgrow the space, but also making sure that those really valuable plantings underneath are continuing to get the light they need is a big part of it as well. And it's just, you know, I'd heard about how rainforest trees just sort of grow year round. But when you're, you know, I grew up in New Hampshire and now I'm here in Washington, like we have a growing season.
Yeah.
And they do grow differently at different times of the year, but just seeing something that essentially grows year round is, it's really mind blowing. And it makes me want to spend more time in the rainforest and experiencing that firsthand.
Totally. Totally. It's so cool. You are so cool. We will link all of your links in the show notes. And I wish you lived closer so you could help us with our tree.
Yeah. Good,
we'll
good luck.
Not be doing it ourselves. We'll be engaging an arborist in Florida to help us. That's for sure.
Sounds good. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right, plant friends, I hope this episode has got you dreaming about your backyard fruit trees. I am itching to get a mango in my backyard. I'm not going to be gardening this summer because obviously I'm freshly postpartum with a baby. But this fall, which is really when Floridian gardens start, I'm going to start thinking about some fruit trees to get in my backyard. And I'm so excited. All of Alan's information is in the show notes if you are interested in learning more from him. And let me know what fruit trees you end up planting after listening to this episode on social media at Growing Joy with Maria. Until next time, my sweet plant friends, keep growing joy. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.